This year is brought to you by Eshel Publications. Eshel Publications is a non-profit organization dedicated to spreading the Torah, Shiurim, and Sefarim of Rabbi Aaron Lapiansky. For sponsorships or more information, visit eshelpublications.com.
When the Nefesh HaChaim breaks down the Pe'ulas of Adam into Machshava, Dibur, and Maisa,
right?
He also doesn't speak about Hagasha there. So would that be Nichlal in his Machshava?
It actually... there's a possibility that it might be Nichlal and Dibur. And let me explain to you why. Let me first quote the Balatanya.
So,
yes, I'm sorry.
Sorry, unfortunately, I disconnected rather than muted myself. What did you say?
Okay. The some people, when they mute themselves, they just disconnect. You know, that's a, it's a profound saying that you just said. It could very well be that it's included in Dibur. And let me explain to you where I'm coming from. The Baal HaTanya explains HaKadosh Baruch Hu's Mitzarev Machshava L'Maisa, that some people, you know, who are naturally not easily, they don't easily become emotional. So they do all the mitzvahs, they sit and they learn about it, they think into it, deeply, and they're focused. But there's no hispilus really coming. So technically, we're missing a step, but HaKadosh Baruch Hu's mitzarev the machshava to the maisa. In other words, he bridges the two. So the Baal HaTanya is sort of taking into account that there could be machshava maisa, like something in the middle. The piece that he's talking about is the dibur. And I want to explain why dibur of all the things would be that. Let's take it on a... yes?
Sorry, I'm not muted, but I really don't understand anything of what you said.
I'm sorry?
I didn't understand that.
Okay. The Baal HaTanya says that the meaning of the Chazal, HaKadosh Baruch Hu's Mitzarev Machshava to Maisa, is referring to a person who does the right things, thinks into it, profoundly so, and yet is not misspoiled from it. There's no emotional reaction in him. So the person thinks about HaKadosh Baruch Hu's greatness. He keeps away from every avera because he realizes that HaKadosh Baruch Hu sees everything and knows everything, he should keep away. And yet, there is no emotional reaction on the person. Still, HaKadosh Baruch Hu's mitzarev, the word mitzarev means to join the two. Mitzarev machshava l'maisa, he joins the two despite sort of to take the place of something in the middle that was supposed to have joined the two. That's what the Baal HaTanya explains. And Tanya, I want to explain that, what that means. So obviously, if we have machshava, we have maisa, that midpoint would be dibur. So let's explain how dibur would be representative of machshava. Of Hargosha that you're calling. A person's diburim fall into a few categories. There are diburim that are, let's call them functional. Pass the salt, don't step over here, it's fresh paint, etc., etc. Those diburim, we understand, are not any expression of any oimek of a person. It may very well be elephants also express themselves that way. When an elephant goes boo, 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 maybe it means don't you dare come here, or else I'm going to whack you, or vice versa. That type of communication is not dibur in any essential sense. The essential sense of dibur that Adam's called a medaber is what's called, in American English at least, to emote. The person gives expression to something which are hargoshes, feelings. Feelings themselves, the etzem sense of it, seems to be a beyond this world sense, awe of beauty, hope for some sort of accomplishment. All of those emotions kind of are not really physical. And the person's ability to give words to them, to bring them into this world so that somebody can convey his pain to me and make me cry, or somebody can convey feelings of joy and make me laugh and smile. Those are all inyanim of that's real dibur. Now, the hargasha of dibur, so dibur is, in other words, the bringing out, just like we explained last time. Emotions are when dry thought sort of strikes a chord, and it sort of causes the person's innards to vibrate, so to speak. It's sort of a crossroads of the two. That's what I, so as when I think in my mind, it is terrible what Assad is doing in Syria to all the Syrians. As long as it's in my mind, that's not an emotion. Even if my mind says, oh, it's terrible, shameful, I don't know how the world can do it. But when I become angry, when I turn red, when I scream, when I talk passionately about it, that's emotion. In other words, it's gone a step further than the dry analysis. The dibur is the primary kli. I can, if I'm emotional, I could swing a fist at somebody. I could do things, but primarily the emotion, I also turn red maybe, I sweat or whatever it is, but my primary vehicle is going to be koach hadibur. Now, another parallel aspect to it, which is fascinating, is dibur is usually when energy crosses certain matter. Wind, which is kind of more ruach, ruchnius, goes across, crosses my vocal cords, I get a dibur. When the energy of a vibration vibrates through some medium, it produces a coil. So coil is sort of a tziruf of the ruchni and the gashmi on a very physical level and on a human level. So if I needed to describe those three things, which of the three is emotion, dibur to me would be the corresponding phase. Okay. Hello.
Don't we see that animals have emotive dibur? The dog that gets its tail stuck in the door.
They have a sense of feelings. They have in line with the fact that HaKadosh Baruch Hu created the Bria as a continuum, they have a lower form of simpler emotions that they do. But there's no, the ability to bring it out really in a real way doesn't exist. You'll see the dog wagging its tail, certainly, and so on and so forth. But it's not the way, it's not the fullness of Perech HaDibur where it's a very, very pale shadow of real Perech HaDibur, with the range of emotions, the depth of emotion, and the breadth of expression are all something you don't find in Baal HaChaim. Rabban does mention the fact that Baal HaChaim have an elementary sense of emotion. He does say that, and that is correct, yes. But it's very important to say that the emotion is complex in the sense it is not the etzem understanding or perception, but it's rather how far has that perception crossed over into the world of Maisa. Has it at least caused my heart to beat quicker? Has it caused a reddening on my face? Has it caused me to scream, to yell, to shout, to clap my hands in joy? That's really where emotion comes in. There's an old Yiddish, folk story kind of, the balagolas were always the coarse, hulking figures in the stories. And a balagola was once at an inn, and after a long day he was sitting and, kind of very hungrily eating up his borscht and potatoes, and the innkeeper gets a telegram that this poor man's wife just passed away. So he comes over to the man and he wants to break the news a bit slowly, and he says, are you married? And the guy grunts yes, and he's working at his potatoes and borscht. Then he says, you know, I think I actually received some report that she might not be all that well. Klum, guys, you know, my sense is that it's really very, very, very serious. First is, you know, he continued with the potatoes, the borscht. He says, you know, I'm really afraid that it's all over and she's no longer with us. And the guy is continuing. And he says, you know, I've never seen such a stone of a person in my life. The guy got very upset and said, when I finish the borscht and potatoes, will I start screaming and carrying on? You've never seen anyone as emotional as me. But Al Kapanim, the emotion is when the sichlius and the tfisa and the avana becomes, expresses itself. It crosses into expression. It's a certain intense thought, a thought with a very, very strong energy and capable of moving things in a physical world. Just like sound is energy moving things physical. Sound cannot travel through a vacuum because it's not striking as anything physical. These things are, so we're talking about an extraordinary Koach Adam, the bridge of the two, which is very parallel to Dibur.
Sorry, Rabbi, just one question.
Yeah.
Isn't that which prevents the I don't know how the Baal HaTanya used it, he put it, but to me it seems like the lave is made of Evin, and therefore it's not Makabel his spilus, no? Isn't that the problem, or is it a Tivius Dika Zach?
It's a Tivius Dika thing, and on the other hand, it is a Teva. In other words, the Baal HaTanya refers to it many times in that way, that it is something which is a Teva in a person, and some people are colder, some people are warmer, but the Baal HaTanya actually gives, between the lines, I would say, and it certainly was the Chabad Chinuch of Chabad. We're distinguishing between Chabad and today. The Chabad philosophy was that if the emotional outpouring and outburst is caused by a frailty of the thing making the sound, it's not very meaningful. For instance, let's give an example. Let's say somebody's seeing my house and says, oh my gosh, it's an earthquake. And I ask him, how do you know? He says, well, don't you see your Leichter is shaking? And I tell him, well, the truth is my poor Leichter it's missing one foot, and one foot is bent out of shape, and there's something under the other foot, so it shakes when you talk. So that's not a sign of any great force. But if, let's say, I have a Leichter that's made out of solid, you know, it's sitting on a big solid base of heavy silver, and it shakes, man, that's a very powerful, oh my gosh, you know, this is a real earthquake. A person who's naturally an emotional person, for instance, a young child's crying doesn't move us terribly, because he cries when he didn't get the right flavor gum that he wanted, and he cries when somebody got served before he did, and he cries when his books are not here, and he cries in this. So we say a child cries easily. An adult, and especially a sort of a stoic adult who's moved and is, you know, to tears, it's a very powerful, because the person's mohus is kind of reserved, and you've caused him, you know, it's very powerful. So the Chabad philosophy was, a person should be as in control of his emotion as possible. A person's natural bearing should be very stoic, which, you know, the kind of Russian, this fit perfectly. But a person's thinking process about HaKadosh Baruch Hu and his godless should be of such powerful impact that even the stone-cold Russian is shaken by it. That's sort of the ideal. In other words, the general thread of that, and that's why Chabad very much eschewed easy emotions. In other words, Rabbi said, let's all shake in the davening and clap and become emotional, was considered to be in poor taste. It was considered to be lousy avodah. What was demanded was don't display emotions, stop thinking about things, and when it explodes, that's real. Someone told me his uncle was actually a Slonimo Chassid, which has a lot of similarities in the sense that they were Litvaks, so they had a similar mentality. He would be sitting and learning and some sort of Chassidus, and he wasn't, you know, kind of sitting quietly, and his face would be turning red, and you would see emotion spread over his face. In other words, he controlled himself from expressing it with his hands and feet, but he was so overwhelmed by the idea that his face and his you know, his sort of countenance gave it away. That was sort of considered an ideal in that that part of the world. Easy emotions were. It's interesting how some overlap. The Pachatzka Levenstein was a big almost a very sharp, and in his last years he stopped crying at Shmuzin or getting emotional, and they asked him why, or explained why. He said, older people are naturally weak and their emotions come out easily, so that would be false expression. In other words, it wouldn't be an expression of the hispilus about the topic, but rather it would be an expression of a personal weakness. I'm weak and just kind of tremble at everything and cry at everything and laugh at everything. So that's not a really good expression. Okay?
Is it an avoider of hargasha? Can you do something about it, or it's the way things hit you and you just...
There is an avoider. The avoider that the person can do and should do is the thought process. In other words, which was, if a person picks an Indian that's close to his heart and he finds words that are meaningful and he thinks into it, he focuses and thinks into it in different ways, those things are meaningful. Because every person can be mizvonein. I don't know if I've shared this with you, but I was once like sort of stunned by something that I had gone over 100 times and never made any impression. When Yosef's brothers came to him and he told them, they apologized profusely and he said, don't worry, and so on and so forth. I've learned this, I don't know how many times since I was a little kid in Mavis Sedra, so on and so forth. It usually, you know, Mavis Sedra is done on autopilot, and that's that. For some reason, I was once paying attention. And I was sort of following the story, and then it hit me like a thunderbolt. Imagine a person is sold by his brothers into slavery, into the dark of Africa. In other words, a 17-year-old, extremely talented and gifted boy, extremely handsome, extremely bright, extremely capable, is taken by his brother, and he's sold into the worst life possible. It's a life of no future. He'll never get married, he'll never have a family, he'll never realize his talents, never accomplish, and be subject to tremendous cruelty. That's the life they sentenced him to. And they never turned around and regretted it. They sold him off, and they never stopped to ask what happened to him, where's he gone, maybe we could save him, I wonder how terrible his life must be. That's how the brothers did it. And the moment comes when they come to him, And they realize the immensity of what they've done, and they're overwhelmed. And his reply is, it really was all hashgacha. I was supposed to end up this way so that I could be of help to you. I started thinking of the life of a Schwarze slave in Louisiana, which is American slavery, and in Africa, and a life that you sold into like that, and the ability to say it. And I couldn't move. I was sort of mesmerized just thinking of it. But was there any new chiddush in what I said, in what I thought? I don't think so. But the thought of it was just incredible. I remember I was just glued. I couldn't take my mind off it. We don't think enough. We don't contemplate enough. We're not misvoting enough. So we don't have it. But as a person is able to misvoting, and, you know, sort of evoke those things, he can do it. You know, again, everyone to his dagger. The Sforno says, Haskis Ushma, Haskis is the Loshim Aseicha, to create an image, to sort of paint an image to yourself. So that's another way of visualizing it, seeing it. But to think, but when a person thinks into it, and a person is overwhelmed by it, like I told over again, I'm sorry if I repeat myself, I just can't keep track. My wife's from the Chazon Ish's family. Her grandmother was a sister of Chazon Ish. Her grandmother was Rebbetzin Greinemann, and she was Chazon Ish's sister. She had, from her husband, she had a sister-in-law called Rebbetzin Edelman. She was a Yisoma at a young age, and they grew up in their house, and she was close to Chazon Ish as well. She passed away actually a few years ago, in the mid-90s or whatever. And she once brought in a rose to the Chazon Ish. She found a rose someplace, plucked it, and sort of brought it in a little vase. And the Chazon Ish saw the rose, and the Chazon Ish began tracing the lines of the rose and its shape and color. Chazon Ish was extremely, extremely visually perceptive. Chazon Ish, you see it in his writings, and you see it, you know, all the stories about his understanding of refuah usually deals with surgery, things like that. He had an extremely vivid way of imagining and seeing things. And he started tracing it and sort of excitedly looking at it, and finally turns and says, take it away from me because I can't anymore. You know, it's kind of overwhelming me. Just take it out. We don't have that. It takes a lot of being able to focus and to think into it and to contemplate. It doesn't require the emotions as much as the process that will ignite the emotions. Okay? Are we...
Maybe just one question for children.
Yeah.
Is there a method in chinuch to help them realize what speaks to them? Or is that just through experience?
I believe it goes through different phases. And I think it's important each age to pick the phase. I mean, I know, for instance, a teenager does need a stronger emotional content. It turns them on. That's the way they are. I remember when I was young and I heard somebody speaking who was very extreme and very, very violently emotional. I really felt, wow, that's Gavaldic, like that's Emes. And if I hear somebody speak who was kind of rational and thoughtful, I was impatient and I sort of felt that he's a compromiser and so on. Today, I think very differently about it. And, you know, and the same people that I was exposed when I was young, I think are not cases. And the people that I wasn't exposed, I think are very profound. You know, I think they are different, but I think a child should be mechunich to think about things and so on. I want to tell you, again, once we're digressing, I guess we'll... I happen to have been an emotional child. I was quite emotional and sensitive. My father, Zechon Ibrach, was an extraordinary person. He was raised in Litva, and he had a lot of the Litvish characteristics of, you know, not being overly sentimental, but my father had very deep sense of regish, and very sort of a thoughtful regish. He was also an older person. He had lost his family in the war. I was basically, could have been my grandfather. He was a shamus in a shul, and it was a big shul. It was like, you know, one of those big, old-fashioned shuls that seats hundreds of people and serves an entire neighborhood. And my father was a shamus and took care of everything. There was a steam room, a boiler room in the shul, where the thing that heated up the whole shul was. And it was sort of a haven for all sorts of homeless people. Jewish, you know, all sorts of misfits and homeless people. It was kind of warm. It didn't have any windows, so nobody went there, and it was kind of unobtrusive. So, you know, they would lay down and sort of talk there and so on. I don't know, every so often it'd be... And there was one... So, being, you know, young kids, you find some amusement in sort of... I don't say we're torturing these people, but that's the metzias. So a group of friends, and myself as part of the group, went in, and, you know, you'd throw something at the guy, he would come chase you, you would you know, whoop with joy and run up and down. He would chase, he'd get tired, he'd be tired in the room, and he'd throw something in again, you know, that type of play. My father served, and he calls me over, and he says, you see that person? I said, do you know he was born, and his mother was delighted, and she hugged him, and kissed him, and loved him. And his father had dreams for him that something would come of him. And, you know, and he had brothers and sisters who liked him and played with him and teased him and went back and forth, so on and so forth. And take a look to what's become of him. Take a look what you're making of him. I remember I was 8, 9 maybe. I started sobbing uncontrollably. And you know, there was, I was permanently cured of that type of activity. It was, you know, and my father didn't say it in an angry tone of voice. My father was very calm, never, very, very rarely lost it. But he said it in a very meaningful way. He made a human being out of him. And it was one of the most powerful experiences. I still remember it. It's just 50 years later, I still remember it as vividly as the day he told it to me. And no anger and no this, just quiet. And I remember sobbing uncontrollably, and, you know, and every time I see a person like that, I think, you know, what happened? Where did Sir Sodom go? Where did all the care and the love and the hope and all that went into a person? You know, but again, it has to be, the trick with children and chinuch is to be able to understand it as a child understands it, not as an adult. You want to impart your values, but the problem is a lot of times you talk to a child in a language that's yours, not his. And there was somebody here, a mechanic, a very fine fellow. He was the principal before, a very nice person, good person. But his voice of admonition was, you ought not to do this. It is unthinkable to do this. It is highly inappropriate to do this. It didn't really cut well. He left and someone else came, and this other person has a very different tone of voice. We're going to do this. We're coming to this. You know, we're going to accomplish. The chachma is to have to understand the voice, the language that speaks to that child. And I find myself, you know, nominally I'm in the base medrash, but there's a high school in the same building, and I have a keshel with the high school kids. I like it. I enjoy it. But I see very clearly there's a certain age at which kids are not good as me. And whatever I'll say, it doesn't mean anything. And then at some point, we'll be able to talk. There'll be some sort of dialogue because we've reached a point where I can speak his language. And that's really the chachma is to speak the language. And it's very, a young boy is on fire. He needs very strong and powerful ideals, languages. A reasoned approach, balanced approach, language doesn't work well with the kid. You can direct them towards balanced activity, but it has to come with a certain heavy emotion. An older person wants something a little more balanced, and a younger boy wants to find chen in you know, be seen as a good boy. The difference is in that way. So it's the tochen that a child should learn to think about others, imagine himself in another person's shoes, and so on. Very positive, but the question is just finding the right language for it. Okay, I mean, that's still. Should we continue? Another question, or what's the.
Should we continue a bit?
Yeah, by the way, once we're speaking about emotions, I think I've told you, Peter. Sometimes cultural differences, you know, South Africans tend to be restrained. They're from good literature stock. Americans tend to be, you know, openly emotional and so on. Aisha Torah taps in very much into that thread of, you know, emotionalism. And the fellow Aisha Torah told me he was doing a tour in South Africa, and he spoke in his first big speech, and he was cracking all his best jokes, and there was nothing from the audience, absolutely no reaction. And he got more and more desperate as he went on, and he pulled out his best ones and his best ones, and nothing was going. Okay, listen, you know, at the end, someone came over and said, Rabbi, you don't know how difficult that speech was for me. I had to do everything in my power not to burst out laughing, because it seemed to have been that it was considered to be impolite to laugh at when the person was speaking. So he was desperately trying to get to laugh, and they were doing their best to sort of hold back on it. And it was a very interesting, I don't know if that's still true, I don't know if it was fit to the audience or whatever. Okay, let's see another small piece here. But again, let's thread back the thread of thought that he was going on. He was explaining the Chazal of the Hamidon, how 13, 11, 6, 3, 2. So the point was, the point that Morales is making is that all of these, what they do is they retain the tsura despite the lack of detail. What Chazal point out in these Gedol Olam, in Yeshaya and David and so on, is the retention of Atsura Klolis, even though it is less and less and less. A mashal, let's take a mashal just to again reinforce the idea. Today it's very hard to use mashalim because all our electronics are printed circuits. In my days, when I was young, you actually had pieces stuck together with wires. So you had a transistor, and you had a capacitor, and you had a resistor, and you had a choke, and you had a this and a that, and you tied, you know, you soldered a wire to a piece and a piece to wire, so on and so forth. And a good machine could be quite complex. A lot of tubes, a lot of wires in there. If somebody says, okay, this radio is too big to take along, it's a great radio, but we can't have something so big. So one person says, okay, I'll cut it in half, and I'll have half a radio. It's only going to play, normally plays at a high volume, and this will play at half the volume, or it will not catch all the stations. Sawing it in half is guaranteed not to give you those results. You're not going to get a half a radio, you're going to get a no radio. You're going to get two pieces of junk. An engineer or somebody knowledgeable could do it. He'll reconfigure and say, okay, we don't need X amount of tubes, or that tubes were for transistors. We don't need this circuit. We can place with this piece. We can leave this out, and we can rewire this, and we'll get something half the size. So there's a tremendous umness to rewire it so that you have something that's meaning something of the original rather than a physical half of the original. That's a very, you know, it's understanding what the yesodas are in a way that you can configure it and make a mini version of it. That's the chiddush. So each and every one of these in a progression, we're able to find less and less lines to do it. Another muscle that we can relate to a little bit better than I don't know, most people, I don't know your ages, but I doubt you remember tubes and chromatic transistors also now. But let's take a painting, a picture. When you take a photograph of somebody, you say, oh, I can recognize Reuven in this photograph because that's for that, it's Reuven. Every single piece is Reuven. When you do a painting, you don't have that amount of detail as a photograph, no way, but it's still quite detailed. When you do a drawing, you have much less detail, but you can still recognize that it's Reuven if it's a good drawing. Sometimes a great artist, like people do the caricatures in newspapers, the cartoon newspapers, need five lines and you say, oh my gosh, that's President Obama. Well, how'd you tell that in five lines? And the answer is, it's suggested. There's a piece from a French philosopher, I think it's Sartre, if I'm not mistaken, about at what point when A is imitating B, at what point does he stop being B and become A? What point does he stop being A? You know, when does the mind make that transition that it's the actor, it's not the actor himself, but it is the person he's playing? It takes sometimes a few simple strokes, and the person says immediately, this is so-and-so. That takes a phenomenal amount of chachma. much more chokhmah than a painting, because a painting is fairly one by the painter has yet to be treifis. But sometimes somebody who does cartoons, it'll be a sort of a slant of the eye that immediately leads you to believe it's him. So all these inyanim. Now, the primary vehicle of being able to extract a tsura to and say, it's this or that, that was the Chachma of Kabbalah. Chachma Kabbalah showed the lines that everything is constructed with, and then mainly you're able to get all sorts of things out of it. I don't think we'll have time actually to do the next piece. Obviously, it's kind of taken us longer. It's a small piece, but what he's doing is the piece before he had talked about the different environment of a person that sort of give you a tsura of the person. And now he's going to talk, if we needed to take of the 10 meters of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, 6 meters, and not even 6, but 3 meters, with their corresponding halves, what would those be? And he picks 3. And that's going to be the next piece. In fact, it's going to take us a bit of time, so I think we should hold it here. Okay, any quick questions? Okay, good. So, good Shabbos.
Okay, good Shabbos. Next week, so Thursday.
So next week, if I realize somewhere that I've made a mistake, I'll let you know. But my feeling is there's no reason why. I mean, I think the chassan is going to be at 6 or 7. It's an hour, but there's no reason why. Okay.
Okay. Good Shabbos. Thanks, Rabbi Lapian.
Shabbos. Okay, bye.